Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM also. That's Preston FM on 103.2 up in Preston in the north and Birmingham Unity FM on 93.5 FM in the Midlands. And also to people downloading South America, I'm told. Hello to you also. Our guest this week is Tess Green, Bristol's only Green councillor who represents the Southfield ward. And our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Greaves, as ever, will be reading another chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Jeff Sparks is not back in the studio actually for his What's On guide this week, but I'll be reading it for him. I'm John Peters Coleman. Welcome to the show. Well, it's over to our guest Tess Green from the Green Party now, but first let's hear a short interview with a chap from Germany, Niels Jacobson, and he's going to speak about the Green Party.
For years we've been greedy and blind, never noticed the damage that's caused by mankind. But now we are being taken to task, and there's one question all children ask:
why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
The hedgerows and ditches have gone. You tell us that's progress, you had to move on. Instead, we've got mountains of wheat and icebergs of unwanted meat. The price paid for power can be high. Chernobyl showed you by clouding the sky, but power could be safe and be free. Use the sun and the wind and the sea. So why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
Things are as bad nearer home. There'll soon be no wild space for children to roam if the builders keep getting their way, destroying the place where we play. We think that there's something obscene about building on fields that are still fresh and green.
My name, Niels Jacobson.
Where are you from?
From Hamburg, Germany.
Can you tell us about the Green Party in Hamburg?
Well, they took up very successfully the green issues, which were popular in the population 20-25 years ago, like acid rain, no nuclear power plants, and things like that. And so they got a lot of votes, a lot of followers in the population. That's how they rose to power in Germany.
Are they still as popular?
I think their popularity has gone down in the recent years. I think it's about 5 years now that they have lost popularity. That's for one reason, due to the fact that they had a very popular leader, Mr. Fischer, who became foreign minister even under the when they were running the country together with the socialist parties. Well, after he stopped his political career, the Greens didn't really have a person people were looking up to.
You said that they were all for abolishing nuclear power. What alternative did they suggest otherwise?
Well, they suggest otherwise green energy like wind energy, water energy, solar energy. But I think the main problem is that if you take away the nuclear power plants, there won't be sufficient energy from all these alternative sources. The green issues today are also addressed by the big two political parties, the socialists and the Christian Democrats. So there isn't really a need for another party who just addresses the green issues.
So there isn't enough green issues to justify a party.
Well, there are enough green issues, but you can't just put up a party, in my impression, and you can't just put up a party based on green issues. A political party running a country needs economical issues as well and needs solutions for the problems arising in these sectors. And the Greens, to me, they always appear like they are having only this green topic. And if it comes to other issues, they don't have very sufficient answers.
So do you think the Green Party is finished in Germany now?
I wouldn't go so far. They still have something between 15 and 20%, depending on the federal country or the country Germany itself. They are not finished, but I think they have seen their peak. I'm not expecting them to really come back.
The piece of music you heard there was the Albion Band. That was Neil Jacobson from Germany. And I'd like to introduce Tess Green. Hello.
Oh, hello.
What do you think of that interview that you just heard? It's quite a scathing review of a party that's quite successful in a way, in some ways, from what he was saying.
Well, it's one person's view, and I would take a very different view. The Green Party is still pretty powerful in Germany, even though they have taken a different path than the Green Party in England. And we're definitely on the up now, so that's different too.
Okay. Congratulations, I suppose, to you, obviously. Caroline Lucas, the Green Party leader, is now MP for Brighton and Hove. Do you hope that, like Herr Fischer, over in Germany, she will become sort of quite a popular leading figure that will go on to lead the Green Party to great success?
Well, I would hope so. I don't know if you've ever heard her speak or seen her on television, but she always comes over so clearly. She's able to explain green policies so that everybody can understand them. She's able to challenge the other main parties on the things they should be doing and say that they're doing but are not doing.
Okay. What do you think about the fact that he said there are a lot of green issues, but does it necessarily mean to say that there has to be a green party? I mean, a lot of other major parties, if lobbied correctly, could be putting through green policies.
Well, I wish that were true, but it isn't. I mean, we've just seen the Lib Dem and Conservative Alliance draw up a green agreement, and it's so vague that they actually don't have to do very much to go through that agreement. And it's not nearly enough. It's going to be too little too late unless we're very careful.
Okay. Speaking as, you know, you're now a councillor, is the Green Party a little bit like a sort of a glorified lobbying group that they speak a lot about green issues and then try and persuade political parties to do a bit more? Or are you going to be sort of more active in enforcing green policies on local areas as you gain councillors throughout the country?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we are gaining more and more councillors throughout the country, and we can put pressure on every local authority. And Greens do believe in starting at home, starting with yourself to start with, your family, your community. That's how it goes, and that's, we must make changes to our lifestyles. And the local council is the nearest democratic unit that we can act on, so we must do that.
Okay, so what sort of policies are you going to try and push forward?
Well, all of the green issues in Bristol that they say that they have, for instance, protecting the green belt, which they're not doing properly, I shall try and make sure that they do more than they would if I wasn't there, because I'm going to be their conscience. I'm going to keep reminding them of their policies that they've made. There are all sorts of other green policies on energy, on equality, so that people are not left not able to heat their homes properly in the winter because they're too poor, that kind of thing.
Okay. I was interested to find out Caroline Lucas is in fact your first leader. So before you didn't believe in having leaders per se. What does that actually mean? Well, how did you operate without a leader?
Well, we're a very democratic party. We hold two conferences every year, and every member of the Green Party is entitled to go to the conference and help to make policy. So that's how we make policies. And all of the people who speak on behalf of the Green Party are accountable to the membership. And our leaders have been made very accountable. They won't have the freedom of action that the conventional parties have.
Okay. How long have you been a member of the Green Party, may I ask?
Oh, gosh, about 15 years, I should think.
Okay. What sort of political persuasions did you have before that?
Well, I'd been a lifelong member of the Labour Party before that, and the Labour Party left me. I didn't leave them.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, the policies that were important to me, about social justice in particular, just didn't seem to be important to the Labour Party anymore.
Okay. Some people might categorise the Green Party as being a generically left-wing party. I mean, in your experience of interacting with a lot of other Green Party members, no doubt, do you find that to be the case?
Not entirely. There are people who've come from all sorts of political backgrounds in the Green Party, but we are a party of social justice, and so we do tend to attract left-thinking people.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the Green Party's history in Bristol specifically. How many councillors have you had in the past? And
well, we've only had one before me. That was Charlie Bolton in the same ward, in Southville ward, in fact. So that's the first success we've had, which was 4 years ago.
Okay. Your decision to stand as a councillor, do you have any experience as being a councillor?
No, I've never been a councillor before. And if Charlie had carried on, I'd be delighted to have supported him in continuing to be a councillor. So it was really because Charlie was standing down, and I live in Southville, and I didn't want us to lose our green voice. That's the reason why I stood.
Okay, so what did you do sort of for a living over the years?
I've done all kinds of jobs, but I suppose a very relevant job was actually being a trade union leader, which I was for 10, 12 years, something like that, probably actually in Bristol.
Okay. What do you think about the Green Party's overall reputation on the major political scale? I mean, do you hope that now that Caroline Lucas is a new MP and things are looking really good, but do you think you might fall prey to sort of Lib Dem syndrome, where there's a lot of positive talking, but you only ever really make small gains?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I think actually the answer lies in the thinking of the majority of people in the population. And I think it's been clear to me that people are very concerned about climate change. Bristol City Council have done a survey recently in which very much more than 70% of the population are concerned about climate change. And in some areas of the city, people are very concerned, classes very concerned about climate change. So those people are tending to look to the Green Party to help to find some solutions.
Okay, so what is your opinion on proportional representation, for example, as a Green Party member?
Well, obviously that's what we want. If we had proportional representation, we'd have far more MPs, we'd have far more councillors, we'd have far more opportunity to influence the political debate.
In recent days, we've had a lot of news stories about, for example, milk. There was one story that was quite interesting. A cloned cow produced some milk that was then sold on the open market, and this was sort of quite of some concern. Have you read about this story? What did you think about it?
I don't know about this story, but I can imagine that there might be some concern. And I think what we'd be worried about here is that people are buying things that they don't know about. They don't know the history of those things properly. And that it is important that people make informed choices.
What is it like being a new councillor? How have you found it? What happens when you sort of become a councillor?
Well, it's very, very busy. They kind of take over your life. It felt like the council was invading my home with all their computer equipment and so on. And then I went through some very intensive induction, which I was afraid it would make me into a different kind of person and not so able to challenge them.
Mm.
But hopefully it hasn't.
Okay, so what are you sort of busy doing most days when you wake up in the morning? What is a councillor's average day?
There isn't an average day. It depends whether I've got a meeting or not. I've got four committees which I serve on. If it's one of those days, I've got preparation to do, and obviously you've got to be at the committee. If it isn't one of those days, there's all sorts of casework to follow up on, and people are always contacting me wanting to know all sorts of things I've got to try and find out the answer to.
Okay. What do you think are the most pressing green issues specifically for Bristol? And obviously there are a lot of general green issues, but what do you think about Bristol specifically and how it's doing as a green city?
Well, it's got a reputation as a green city, but everybody knows that the public transport is terrible and traffic is a major problem for Bristol, and I think that's the one we have to tackle.
Okay, how do you think we're going to go about that? That's going to be quite a tricky problem, isn't it? I mean, first they've got a bit of a monopoly really, haven't they?
Yes, that's one problem. And we are a cycling city and we have got a lot of cyclists, and it's obvious really, you can see that. But it's still not very safe for cyclists and it's not very safe for walkers, and we've got to start there, the easiest things.
Okay, and what are your best hopes for what you hope to achieve over your coming years as a councillor?
Well, I'm hoping that I would be able to do something to improve transport. I'm hoping that I would be able to spread the word about environmental issues. I'm hoping that I'd be able to do something to halt the spread of supermarkets, which are undermining people's choices.
Excellent. Well, I wish you the very best of luck and congratulations on becoming a councillor, and all the best. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, time now for our first feature, courtesy of Tony Gosling. Well, we've all heard the struggle of the Old Vic to stay open, and with a massive injection of public money, Indeed it has. But there is another theatre in Bristol city centre which has been closed, possibly for good, by the very people who are supposed to be its guardians. Nearly 20 years ago, Bristol City Council closed the only theatre that could be used by amateur and semi-professional drama groups to put their best productions on. But they promised that it would be refurbished and reopened. But they reneged on their promise, and the unique Little Theatre, which is on Colston Avenue, just in the middle of town, was never refurbished and never reopened. And in fact, I never even knew about it until very recently, and it's been slowly crumbling ever since. Next week, we'll be asking why the council has effectively prohibited this unique sort of drama from taking place in the Bristol city centre. But first this week, we'll look at a similar struggle, which has been taking place in Rhyl in North Wales, and the struggle their local people have had to keep their local theatre open.
My name is Neil Taylor. I'm the secretary of the Rhyl Little Theatre, which is the first purpose-built theatre for children in the UK, built in 1963. I got involved in around 2001. It had been an unincorporated association run by people who had a good idea. They wanted to help, but they had no management experience. And I was brought in as a solicitor to change it from an unincorporated association into a charity and company limited by guarantee. Unfortunately, the lease was due to run out in 1985. We applied in 1984 for a new lease. The council wanted us out, sent a surveyor around who did a report saying that there was £34,000 worth of work needed to be done. We had a go at it. We applied to the court for a new lease. The council realised we'd done some work, so we had a 3-year lease to finish it off. We hadn't finished it all off, but it was mainly cosmetic work. We applied to the court again, and in February, after the 3-day hearing in which the council opposed our application, the judge granted us a 12-year lease, which we now have, but we have to finish off this work by January, and obviously we need help and support to get it done. But we've got the Children's Theatre Club back up, we've got a youth group back up, we've got people inquiring about an adult group. We're looking at expanding and developing the theatre so that we can take on more activities. We are conscious of the fact that we are part of the community, and we are using it to the rehearsal room for community groups. We're hoping to develop that into what's known as a training room, but also add on another rehearsal room, a dance studio and a sound studio, so we can accommodate mainly young people, but people who are involved in bands, so that they can record their demo tapes as well. So it's a part of the community. It is a fully functional theatre. It's a proscenium arch theatre. It's nearly about 192 seats. There is an amateur dramatic group that uses it, and it's available to hire, and we do get groups coming round. We're probably well known, for the one thing that we are well known for, is that this is where in one general election ago, where John Prescott was hit by an egg. It was outside the theatre. He was having a meeting in the theatre for the Labour Party in North Wales, and that's our claim to fame. But as I say, we are the first purpose-built theatre for children. We want to develop, we want to expand, because we are well aware of the benefits that people have from going through drama school, learning how to express themselves, learning self-confidence, and getting that unique opportunity of actually appearing on a stage and uttering lines. We've had children from special needs schools. One of them, Joe, which his parents could not believe he was on stage, and he actually said one sentence, and they could not believe it. And this is something we're proud of. People who have gone through that theatre have gone on to be at the top of their profession. Not all of it is acting, not all of it is in drama, but it's given them the self-confidence to get on, to study, to work, to learn, and go to university and college and get to the top of their profession.
Can you just give us an example of the productions that you've had on there recently?
The last thing we had on, which was only a week ago, was wrestling. The week before that, the Southwest Rhyl Communities First. Now, you may not have Communities First wards in England, but basically they're deprived wards. I'm vice chairman of the Communities First Partnership, and there are a lot of community groups, and we had an evening, it's at Star for the Night, and it was a lot of, there were two schools who had choirs, there were two dancing groups there, there was a martial arts group, there was an aerobics athletic group there as well. We've had on the Rhyl Liberty Players, it was their base until we had problems with the lease. There are a number of amateur dramatic groups that perform there. There are touring groups. Saltmine Theatre Company, a religious-based group, they tour the UK. They've put productions on there. We've had art exhibitions in there. Again, we've had it for political meetings. There was the one with John Prescott, and last year it was a hustings meeting for leader of the Wales Labour Party. The three candidates were there. It's a theatre, and it's hired out for all sorts of uses for seminars, training courses, as well as we didn't actually have a group there dancing for the disabled, and we have that sort of group who hire the rehearsal room and have their activities which benefits the community.
It does sound a little bit peculiar that you've had all these problems getting the lease renewed. Do you think the council is simply trying to make sure that the place is safe?
One of the reasons, and you won't find anybody in real, or not many, who would not say that is a valuable piece of real estate near the centre of town. The council did say there were problems with health and safety, fire risk, child protection and disability discrimination. Those were aired at the court hearing in February in Carnarvon, and the judge threw them out. The only thing he found on the council's behalf was that we hadn't completed the agreed list of work, which is mainly cosmetic. There was a survey last week, and we met with council officials who have now said, we accept that you've done a first-class job, we accept that if it wasn't for the present management, there'd have been a for sale sign outside. So I think they're now realising that what they wanted to do was, if you like, sell the building and land for redevelopment. There are now a consortium that wants to take over the theatre. We've had discussions with them. We're not quite sure how we're going to go. We may be part of a consortium. The reason being, there's a thing called a community asset transfer scheme, which the last tranche has to be in by the end of September. But what it means is it's big lottery funded, the freehold is passed on to the organisation, and there's lottery money of about £800,000 to develop it. And that's what our next priority is.
In the age of the internet and television, is there really any need for theatre anymore in Britain?
Certainly there is. There is a need for young people in particular to express themselves, to be themselves, to learn how to work as a team. Because if you're in a play, the first thing you have to do is read the part you're going to play. So you improve your reading skills. You have to work as a team. You can't be the dominant person in the pack. You have to be part of a team. And you learn a lot of skills. Theatre is not just people on stages, it's people in a lighting box, it's people who make scenery, people who make costumes, people who are on the side as stage managers, as production managers. So there are a whole lot of skills involved in running a theatre, not just people who want to sing and dance. That's only part of it, a small part of it.
That was Neil Taylor from Real Little Theatre. Bristol Little Theatre, or what's left of it after the City Council's neglect, is on the left as you go up Colston Street, sorry, not Avenue. And we'll have more on that story and an interview next week. Well, our theme has been about the green issue and politics and stuff like that. So here's a song from the Albion Band, which we played before on Dialect, but not for a long while. So it's called Tomorrow's Too Late.
Within days of the fallout from Chernobyl drifting over Britain, all the samples from Cumbria exceeded the action level suggested for removing livestock from grazing out of doors. If an accident to a reactor over 1,000 miles away can wreak such havoc, then what would be the consequences if Sellafield were to go up?
Nobody thought we could lose things so fast. grandparents' time, there was wildlife galore, but most of it's gone since the end of the war. Things started out well with the National Park.
Rhine and other large rivers dump only slightly less toxic pollution into the North Sea than in the 1970s, and the threat of irreparable damage to marine life remains undiminished. The amount of rubbish thrown into the seas every year now outweighs the world fish catch by 3 to 1.
That was the Albion Band, and that was a song called Tomorrow's Too Late. Well, we've heard a little bit about the Freemasonry before on the show. It's another feature from Tony Gosling about Freemasonry. Bill Schnoblen is a former Freemason. Last week we heard all about the Jack the Ripper murders and their links, as he sees it, to Freemasonic ritual. And this week has promised Masonic presidents.
Most politicians, as everybody has probably observed, tend to be lawyers. As we've already discussed, most lawyers are Masons. Therefore, a lot of politicians are Masons. Many heads of state are Masons. At least 17 presidents of the United States have been Freemasons. Let's talk about the Revolutionary War period. I've already mentioned that Benjamin Franklin was a Mason. Franklin, Benedict Arnold, Paul Revere, George Washington, possibly Jefferson, we don't know that for sure. John Adams was a strong anti-Mason, though. Now let me talk for a moment about Washington, though. The Masons make an incredible amount of hay out of the fact that Washington was a Mason. I mean, I'm sure some of you have even seen, like around the time of Washington's birthday, they have ads in the paper, you know, showing Washington presiding over the Grand Lodge and so on and so on. Let me tell you something. All of that is basically fiction. I document in my book, Masonry Beyond the Light, the fact that, yeah, Washington was a Mason. He joined when he was an officer in the British Army in his youth, dare I say, before he knew better. Additionally, in those days, if you wanted to get anywhere in the officers' corps of the British Army, you had to be a Mason. But I have a letter documented in my book that proves that at the end of his life, Washington wrote a clergyman. And he said that he had not been inside of a Masonic lodge for 30 years. So much for him being a devout Mason. I think he basically figured out early on that there was nothing that he needed to belong to and basically just walked away from it. There was no teaching in those days that you had to renounce Masonry or do anything like that, and so he just basically stopped going. And he made that very clear. Plus, on his deathbed, he denounced Masonry because he had discovered it had become a tool for bringing the Illuminati into America. How about 20th century politics? Look at all these darlings of the conservative right. Jesse Helms, Bob Dole, Strom Thurmond, Ronald Reagan, who was made an honorary Mason, Gerald Ford, Harry Truman, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. All of these people were high-level Masons, with the exception of Reagan, who was just made an honorary Mason. Now, think of that. All these people, except Reagan, have taken Holy Communion out of a human skull. because that's what's involved in being a 33rd degree Mason. And you would not believe the oath that these people have to take. They swear that they will work for the destruction of law, religion, and government. And then you wonder why this is so bizarre today in our government, our political system. Freemasonry has been called America's civil religion, and rightly so. You will often find Masonic worshipful masters laying the cornerstones for civic buildings. I'm sure some of your civic buildings, like post offices or courthouses, have had blessings by Masonic worshipful masters. And of course, a blessing from a worshipful master is like a curse.
That was Bill Schnorbelin, who is himself a former Freemason. Thanks to Dalek's Tony Gosling for that report. And if you want to find his entire talk on the internet, it's called Light Behind Masonry. So if you pop that into your favoured search engine, that will come up.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature by Anthea Page was recorded during her recent trip to Bulgaria and Romania. And this was going to be the second part of Luca's account of the communist era in Sofia. But instead, we're going to hear an interview with a young student, Sonia, who works at the youth hostel in Plovdiv in central Bulgaria. It's about life in Bulgaria today from a young person's point of view.
Can you tell us about the situation in Bulgaria, how you see it, living here and working here?
Bulgarian reality is really different, and probably it's ununderstandable for the people who come from Western Europe, because here is pretty much a chaos. There's nothing right, and there's nothing which it should be. I'm not much of into politics, but we here, we are absolutely responsible for that. We can't manage with life. And most of the people, most of the young people, they prefer to go abroad to search something in Europe or in United States instead to stay here and to try to do something for their country. And it's one of our biggest problems.
Tell us about your family, your father, because I think that was quite traumatic.
I came from family of engineers. My mom is an engineer and my dad also. And they're really great specialists. And my dad lost his job 3 years ago. And just because they took one guy on his place because he knows someone on high level with money.
In the government?
Yes. And they've changed the government and they took their guy.
Is this common?
It is common, yeah. You can see it every day.
So do you think the system's corrupt in Bulgaria?
Of course. Everyone knows it. It's something that you don't talk about it, but you can see it.
So what's happening to the country financially, economically?
Economically, we are absolutely weak because we don't have an agriculture. We just have our touristic cities on the seaside. And we think that if they are okay in the summer, the economics will run properly all the time. But it can't happen like that.
Is that a bit risky? Because people have been telling me that everyone's going to Turkey this year.
Yes, it is. But here in Bulgaria, we never have rich tourists. We have tourists from Germany and Russia and the other from Central Europe, because they don't have money to go to the biggest place in Turkey or Greece, and they prefer to stay here on the Black Sea in Bulgaria.
So does Bulgaria manufacture much?
We have, but everything is little business here. No one does something big, and no one wants to put money in something which is not sure and which is not secure to get some money later.
You have a very small population as well, don't you? 7 million over the whole country.
Yes, but our country is small, so we are not so many. And the problem is that the young people, they don't want to have kids because they don't know how they'll manage their lives.
They won't know how to fund a family.
Yes, because they always live in fear that they can't manage with money and they'll be penniless and they'll have kids that they can't do nothing
support
with it. Yes.
What's the size of an average family over here? Is it 2 children, 1 child?
1 child or 2 children. Yeah, that's it. My family is me, my sister, my mom and dad. So that's 4. It's pretty common. We have regions in Bulgaria where the population is a little bit different. So in the mountains, in the Rodopi Mountains, we have whole villages with Muslim population. They have more kids. It's normal. But in the big cities, it's normal to have 2 kids, not more.
So do many people go to university here?
Yes. In my circle, everyone is a student in the university. We have my sister is in Sofia. She lives in Sofia. She's studying in the Sofia University. I am student here in Plovdiv. But the problem with the university is that it's really hard to study and to work, to live alone. So you choose. Either you want to live alone and to get a job, or you can study and stay living with your parents, which is a little bit embarrassing for a young person.
So what do you think the worst problem is facing Bulgaria at the moment?
The problem is that the politics, they don't have ideas. They just want to be in the politics and take profit of it. They don't have a clear idea what to do to Bulgaria to be okay.
To improve the situation.
Yes.
Who's in control, left or right?
Now we have a strange party, which is, I think, in the middle. I don't want to talk about the government, because for me it's really strange to have a prime minister which is an ex-bodyguard. Before the last, we had the prime minister, which was a king. Yeah, he was the son of our last king before the monarchy falls and Bulgaria to become a republic.
And now you've got a lifeguard.
Yeah, a bodyguard.
What's his name?
It's Boyko Borisov. And he was a bodyguard of our communist leader. It's funny. It's really strange.
Are there a lot of poor people here?
Yes. We are all poor for the Western European. It's really strange because our social status is really different from theirs. And that's why I'm saying that it is really hard to understand the situation from outside. You have to live here and to live for an ear to five to understand what is the situation exactly.
Why do you have these economic problems then?
I think that it has his historical side, and the other thing is that every government, they don't want to build the future over the past successes. They just ruined everything and then start over, and it's not right.
Is that a legacy from the Soviet era?
No, I don't think so. I think that dates really, really long before that.
But the older people, do they think it was better under communism or not?
Yes, most of them, they think, because no matter what, everything was arranged.
Organized?
Yes, organized.
And now it isn't?
No way. In Bulgaria, now, you don't know what to do because there's no organization anywhere. I think that here we study English in school, so everybody understands the tourists, but they're afraid to talk with them. And we have problem with the tourists because we don't have signs, even in Bulgarian. Yeah, we don't have signs, we don't have schedules of buses and trains, something which is really, really important for a traveler. And we want to make tourism and to build our economy on it. It's really strange.
It doesn't seem well organized for tourism.
Yes, it's not. It's here, it's Bulgaria. Here, nothing is organized. You always wonder what will happen at the end.
That was Anthea Page there, talking to Sonia in Plovdiv in central Bulgaria. Well, as ever, straight out of Swindon, our very own Malcolm Grieve will read another instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
Secrets and Lies, Let Out of the Bag by David Southwell. The cult of personality breeds many dangers, including the tendency to refuse to acknowledge the truth about an icon's flaws and failings. Individual people, and sometimes even whole countries, invest so much emotion and pride in their heroes that they develop an inability even to be open to the possibility that they lied and concealed elements of their lives. Respected global figures, many of them regarded as national heroes and cultural icons, are just like you and me. They have certain secrets that they would rather stayed hidden. One difference, however, is that they tend to have a lot more people who are more than happy to lie and cover up, to protect their inflated reputations for them. When the propaganda and cheerleading machinery kicks in, history has a tendency to be rewritten, and flesh and blood political leaders can easily become saints, while any quirky signs of individuality such as mystical beliefs are repressed. All evidence of drug use, sexual adventures and personal misjudgment are ignored. Some lies told by an icon's supporters are deliberately intended to bolster their public image. If these go unchecked because of the esteem in which they are held, they can become inflated to the status of almost university-held belief. However, the most common lies told about public figures are those of omission. These mislead people into having a less than complete picture of a well-known figure, especially about any earlier political beliefs or elements in their personal lives that conflict their later status. Henry Kissinger is regarded by many as the statesman supreme of the 20th century, and a regular and well-respected TV news talking head. Amongst the many areas of his career that Kissinger likes to keep quiet about are his former views on nuclear war. In the 1950s, Dr. Kissinger wrote Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy. The book makes for frightening reading, as Dr. K advocates just how the US should aim to use nuclear weapons to win a war. His favourite option is an agreement with the Soviet Union to use only limited-range nuclear weapons and only in European and other non-homeland territories. If you read the book, it is clear that Kissinger believes a nuclear war is winnable and at times the favoured option to achieve US dominance. Obviously, Kissinger no longer believes this to be the case.
It was such views that have convinced many experts and academics that Kissinger was one of the inspirations of the character of Dr. Strangelove in Stanley Kubrick and Peter Sellers' hilariously scary movie Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. In 1973, Kissinger was US Secretary of State and, with Nixon embroiled in the Watergate scandal, effectively the most powerful man in the world. On October the 24th, 1973, Nixon was too concerned with trying to save his presidency to make a meeting of military chiefs discussing fighting between Israeli and Egyptian forces. Kissinger attended and ordered the US move to DEFCON 3 because he thought the Soviets might intervene. During this high state of alert, a false alarm led B-52 crews to rush to their planes. Thankfully, the planes did not get airborne, because with Dr. Strangelove in charge... Henry Kissinger is a man who has played a pivotal role in world affairs. Even though no longer in government, he and his views on world affairs are still given a lot of airtime. Amongst the many areas of his career that Kissinger does not seem to talk about much in broadcast interviews are his former views on nuclear war. There is a good reason why governments keep secret the more eccentric beliefs of its military leaders from the public. Knowledge that commanders of the war believe they are reincarnations of historical characters, as was the case with General George Patton, or that they can contact the dead, is not seen as good for morale on the battlefield or home front. The fight for air supremacy over the skies of England between the Royal Air Force and the German Luftwaffe in 1940 saved Britain from Nazi invasion and has gone down in history as the Battle of Britain. It is acknowledged that victory was largely due to the work of the Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command, Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding. His appointment as head of Fighter Command in 1936 put him in charge of developing the Spitfire and Hurricane and the embryonic use of radar. During the Battle of Britain, his understanding and careful use of fighter aircraft, combined with his expert knowledge of the air defence network, were crucial to victory. It was therefore a subject of much controversy that he was not promoted after 1940 and sidelined into economic planning. Dowding himself was so frustrated with the situation that he resigned from the RAF in 1942. Although attributed in 1940 to political intrigue, one of the secret factors in his downfall was his advocacy of spiritualism and application of unorthodox techniques in warfare. A member of the Ghost Club of London, Dowding would recommend that widows of his fighter pilots lost in action visit mediums to contact their dead husbands. He himself believed he had the ability to talk to the dead, and more than once took advice on strategic matters from the other side, believing that the spirits of dead aircrew might be able to provide information not obtainable by British spies. Dowding also used dowsing when trying to work out the best location to place air defence installations. Although not a patch on Nazi use of magic during the war, his colleagues much preferred to believe in Spitfires over spirits. Whatever image goes through your mind when you hear the name Winston Churchill, I sincerely doubt it is of the man voted Greatest Britain dressed in Druid's robes, celebrating the solstice at an ancient megalithic site. It is well known that Churchill was a Freemason for a few short years, leaving the Brotherhood in 1912. His membership of Druidic orders and participation in various Druidic rites and festivals is a fact that is banished from almost all of the hundreds of biographies on Britain's wartime leader. Even the one or two biographies that make mention of his membership are always at pains to suggest it was either a brief flirtation or that his involvement was entirely honorific. While that might be the version the hagiographers of Churchill would like to have us believe, it is not the truth, as he remained a Druid throughout his life. Occult and mystical orders, especially those that are secret or semi-secret, do not tend to produce much in the way of written evidence such as membership lists. When Churchill was initiated into the Ancient and Archaeological Order of Druids in 1908, it was not a story covered in the national papers, even though the prospect of the then government cabinet member and president of the Board of Trade enrolling in an organisation which carried out neo-pagan rituals was certainly newsworthy. In fact, it was not until the publication of Stuart Pigott's book, The Druids, that even many Druids themselves knew that Churchill had been one of their number. Churchill was not just an armchair Druid, although no firm evidence shows him joining other Druids in celebrating the midsummer solstice at Stonehenge. Churchill did join the Albion Lodge in midwinter solstice rituals held at the Rollright Stones, a stone circle in Oxfordshire. Whether his willingness to consider the occult during the Second World War stemmed from his occasional donning of white robes is a matter that historians have failed to look at, because they continue to pretend that he was too busy being a politician to do anything as interesting as being a druid.
Thank you very much to David Southwell for not only writing the book, but letting us read it out on air. And that was his Secrets and Lies, available from all good shops now. Well, as I stated earlier on, our dear old Jeff Sparks is away on his holes this week. So hope you're having a good time wherever you are. But he's mailed us in his What's On Guide for the 3rd of August. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday the 13th of August, and the Benita Johnson Project will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road in Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and the gig starts at 8:30pm. On to Saturday the 14th, New Roads will be performing a farewell gig with support from My Friend Friday at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. And the doors open at 8 and the entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I'll feature the Purple Gang. They formed in 1966, released the Purple Gang Strikes album in 1967, eventually splitting up in 1972. In 1998, several members reformed the group and are still performing to this day. This is from the Purple Gang Strikes album and is a track titled Granny Takes a Trip, which was named after a shop, which was opened in London at around that time.
Well, she lives all alone in a house by a pool. She wears fur coats and hats and old-fashioned jewels, and her one aim in life to be on the screen, top billing with ballet. Takes a trip, always first class, and she's well equipped for the movie auditions in Hollywood town. She always turns up, but she's always turned down.
That was the Purple Gang with the track Granny Takes a Trip from the album The Purple Gang Strikes. For more information, you can check out thepurplegang.co.uk. Also on Saturday the 14th of August, The Dwarves will be performing with support at The Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm, tickets are £10 in advance. On Saturday the 14th of August and Sunday the 15th of August, it's Corrie Fest, which is at the Coronation Tap in Sign Place, up in Clifton in Bristol. Expect performances by acts such as Flash Harry, James Morton & Co, Phil King Trio, and many more. Not forgetting, of course, their fine exhibition cider, which it's 11%, I think, is only available in half pints. Loads of fun, and lots of hangover. The festival starts at 12 noon each day, and the entry is free on both days. So that's the Coronation Tap, Saturday the 14th, Sunday the 15th of August. Well, that's all from me via Jeff Sparks. Thank you very much to Jeff. Before we wind up this week's show, Claire Lees is here from Amnesty to tell us all about the fundraising events at Goldney House in Bristol. In fact, this very afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about what the event is and how it relates to Amnesty, what it's for.
It's an event that is organised by the local group of Amnesty International every year, and it's been for the last 28 years. This is the 28th year, and it takes place in the gardens of Goldney Hall, which is a halls of residence of the university, which is a historic building, and is only open to the public two or three times a year, one of which is Goldney Garden Party. And all the proceeds of the party go to Amnesty International to help carry on the work of Amnesty International. And it's a huge event. It's always really well received. It makes a lot of money for Amnesty, so we're very proud of it. And it's a great, great event for all the family. Lots of stuff to do, lots of stuff to see. Quite happy to start reeling off all the stuff that you can do, unless you want to ask me about it.
Yeah, why not? Go on,
Well, first of all, there's the grounds themselves. This beautiful garden, beautiful buildings. There's a grotto in the middle, which is what you call a folly, which was built at the time by somebody who was rich and wanted something special. So they had this little grotto built in the middle of the grounds, which is completely lined with seashells. There's a statue of Neptune in the middle and a fountain, etc. And it's quite special. So it's well worth going to see. And again, like I said, you won't have an opportunity to see this outside of those two or three special occasions in the year.
Okay.
So it's a very good opportunity to do this. And in addition to that, because of Amnesty, there'll be cake, there'll be music, there's two choirs.
Well, cake is really the deciding factor there, isn't it?
Honest. And it's the first thing you see when you walk in as well.
Brilliant.
You come in and you go into the orangery, which is part of the building, and all you see is this sea of cake.
Okay, where is Goldney House and the sea of cake? Where can we find this cake? Tell us, quick.
If you'd like to drown yourself in cake, come to Constitution Hill in Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Very steep.
Yes, a little bit. So,
okay, so you can work off the calories of the cake.
That's
it all works out very well. We're getting there now. There's a pattern to this. Good.
Yes.
Constitution Hill, Clifton, Bristol, this very afternoon.
Absolutely.
When does it sort of close up, finish?
It's up until 5:00, and really don't be afraid to come a bit late, because we save the best for last. The choir I sing in is on at 4:00.
Ah, brilliant. Okay. Well, it's on this afternoon, so get your skates on, finish up your lunch. You can listen to the radio or do your gardening another day. Get to Goldney House on Constitution Hill. Claire Lees from Amnesty, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Just briefly before we go, there's also time to mention the Three Choirs Festival. I've got a leaflet here in front of me. Three Choirs Plus, adding an extra dimension. This is based in Gloucester and takes place from the 7th to the 15th of August. So there's still time to go and see some stuff. It's got a little blurb about it. It says it's an integral part of the Three Choirs Festival and comprises an unusual and entertaining musical and non-musical range of activities that take place alongside a whole range of activities. The programme specifically shining a spotlight on creative talents of Gloucestershire artists, singers, dancers, actors, craftspeople and all-round entertainers. But it generates a sustainable and comprehensive outreach programme as well, which includes opportunities for the more vulnerable members of society. And over the page, it's just got a bit about an organisation called Mind Song, who are being represented at the festival. They work with people with dementia in Gloucestershire, mainly in care homes and stuff. And they sort of try and get people with neurodegenerative disorders and the like to try and experience the enjoyment, well-being and empowerment of music as a sort of a therapy thing. You can also go and see community music events like Jazz Psalm Sunday, an adult community music project. I've got Magic Song Dance, which is a children's music project, arts and crafts, theatre and entertainment, workshops, illustrated talks. More than I can really mention, all in sort of one blurb. Suffice it to say, it's in Gloucestershire, if that sounds like your thing. Check out www.threechoirs.org, and that's the number 3 and the word choirs. threechoirs.org. Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Tess Green, for coming in from the Green Party. Features were Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, and Malcolm Greave, Red Secrets and Lies. And Jeff Sparks for presenting, or not presenting, the What's On Guide, but emailing it to me. Thank you for doing that. And the studio engineer was Mike Noyes, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman. You can check out us on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk. We're also available on radioforall.net, which is radio, the number 4, all.net. That's a very good website if you like community radio from all over the nation, all over the world indeed. And you can also check out the BCFM website, 93.2, and that's bcfm.org. That's goodbye from myself. See you all next week. Goodbye.